from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Right now, all across the Bay Area, thousands of high school students are learning whether they got into their college of choice. Admissions decisions have an alchemy all their own, but on top of grades and test scores, activities and athletics, do high-achieving Asian American students have another hurdle to climb? Some argue that what amounts to an unofficial cap on Asian American students unfairly reduces their numbers at certain elite schools. And there's also concern that revised standards for the UC system will hurt Asian American student admissions as well. We'll take a look at this topic next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. 4 years ago, 17-year-old John Lee sent off his college applications to some of the country's best universities. He had perfect SAT scores, 2,400 out of 2,400. But he still didn't get into some of his top choices, including Princeton. In the end, he felt he'd been unfairly discriminated against because he was Asian American, that in effect, Princeton had an unspoken double standard. He filed a complaint with the Office for Civil Rights, a complaint that is apparently still under review. So does the high number of qualified Asian American students wind up working against them, especially when seeking admission to some of this country's top academic institutions? And here in California, there's also fear that new University of California admission standards will also have an unintended impact on Asian American students. So we're going to take up this topic this hour of Forum. Joining us first, Lingxi Wong. He's Professor Emeritus of Ethnic Studies and Asian American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, where he taught for 40 years. Professor Wong, good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Happy to have you join us. Joining us as well, Angela Sa-Um. She's founder of Boston Academic Consulting Group and a former admissions officer at both MIT and at Harvard. Angela Sa-Um, good morning.
Glad to be here. It's afternoon here in Boston.
Good afternoon, then. Thanks for being with us. And Daniel Golden joins us as well. He's author of The Price of Admission, How America's Ruling Class Buys Its Way into Elite Colleges. He's also a Pulitzer Prize, former Pulitzer Prize winning reporter at The Wall Street Journal, today editor-at-large at Bloomberg News. Mr. Golden, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
In a little while, we'll also hear from Mark Rashid. He's chaired the UC Admissions Board from 2006 to 2008, and he'll join us when we get to that part of our discussion about the University of California standards in this. But let's talk about this problem and to what extent it is indeed an issue for Asian American students. Daniel Golden, when you wrote your book, you focused on this issue in part. You also looked at many other aspects of admission standards for elite universities, but you did feel that this was a particular issue. Do you still feel that way today, that Asian American students are underrepresented at some of the top universities in the country?
They're overrepresented compared to their population, but they're underrepresented compared to their academic achievement. I mean, what I found was that they were held to a higher standard in admissions in terms of SAT scores, and Tom Espenshade, a Princeton sociologist, recently reported that Asians are at about 140 SAT point disadvantage compared to other groups. And it's not just SATs. Tom Friedman of the New York Times actually had a column a few days ago where he mentioned attending the dinner right. for the winners of the Intel Science Fair, and virtually all of them were Asian American. And I looked at a whole variety of top achievements by American students, such as Presidential Scholars, AP Scholar, Intel Science Fair, and others. And Asian Americans routinely make up at least a third of the winners. And yet, if you look at the Ivy League, for example, the percentage of Asian students is more like 10 to 20%.
So underrepresented in terms of what their academic record, both in terms of grades and SAT scores, might suggest. And in the study that you mentioned by Thomas Heppenshade at Princeton, when you say there's a 140-point differential, essentially he is making the argument that in order to compete, an Asian American student has to score 140 points more than the competition. Is that right?
That's right. That's what he argued in there. And, you know, other people have had other numbers, but, you know, there's no question that they need a, you know, a higher test score is required for an Asian student to be on an even ground. And Asian students know this. I mean, when I was doing my book, I met with a group of, you know, Asian American students at a top New York high school. And one of them, a young woman, she said to me, oh, I said, how did you do? And she set her test score, which was very high, and she had good grades. And I said, congratulations, that sounds, you know, terrific. And she said, oh, no, we call this an Asian fail. You know, because it wasn't a perfect test score and it wasn't a perfect grade point average.
Angela Saham, you've read many of those applications at both MIT and Harvard. Do you concur with Dan Golden that Asian American students have a tougher bar to climb?
Well, I actually have a different perspective, having been on the inside and also currently my role as a private consultant. I think the main question or issue really is, what are the qualifications for an Ivy League university? What do they look for? The fact is they look beyond GPA and test scores. That's just the very beginning. And it really depends on how you define, you know, what private school admissions offices are looking for. They're looking for individuals and talent and potential and character and personality, all these things that make a private school application so complex and complicated. It's far beyond just numbers. It's more than a number game.
And so do you feel that Asian American students are not disadvantaged, that it is an even playing field?
Well, let's put it this way. There is no perfect system, because this is a system with flawed individuals, and no one is perfect. No one is absolutely non-discriminatory. But we do strive, even in my training, I remember back to when I was being trained to read folders, it was very clear that we were going for building an ideal freshman class. And that goes beyond just numbers. If we were just looking at GPA and test scores, we'd have, you know, still 40,000-50,000, you know, individuals that could qualify. But we had to boil it down to 2,000 and or less, and we have to look beyond that. That's where, for example, Asian students, they don't understand. It's not just a perfect SAT score that AOs or admissions offices are looking for.
What about your perspective on this, Professor Wong, Ling-Chi Wong, longtime professor at the University of California, Berkeley? Where do you come down on this? The two opinions now we've heard from both Dan Golden and Angela Saham, that on the one hand, if you look at it from a purely rating standpoint, numbers, SAT scores, grades, Mr. Golden's making the argument that Asian American students really should occupy a larger percentage of those elite universities. Heard Angela Saham say, you know, it's not just about the numbers.
Well, you know, the public has this understanding about getting into the top university requires, you know, tremendous test scores and GPAs. In other words, the admissions process is governed by something called meritocracy. But in reality, of course, throughout history, that is not the case. Even at institutions such as Harvard, MIT, Princeton, and Yale, for one thing, for instance, I think Harvard was founded in 1637 or 1647. And for over 300 years, Harvard had only one affirmative action, and that's for white, male, Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Jews were excluded, women were excluded, minorities were excluded. It was only until the 1960s of the Civil Rights Movement that finally they opened the door. So it was never based on meritocracy, even though the public impression was meritocracy rules. So this is, you know, we know that the getting into the elite university is a scarce resource, and so people have to struggle to get in. But who defines merits in our society? And I think Mr. Daniel probably suggests that it's the elite who controls these institutions that defines what constitutes meritocratic criteria.
Well, indeed, and I'm sure Dan Golden can chime in on this, but one of his arguments is that the biggest affirmative action program of all at elite universities is whether or not you are the son or daughter of an alumnus and whether or not you give a lot of money to the university, that there are lots of things that weigh in beyond just scores. But I want to stay with this question, though, of whether or not Asian American students whether it's because they may not have some of these other activities to round out the numbers, mm-hmm. or whether or not there's just a feeling, look, we want to have a diverse student body, and that means we don't want to have a student body that's 30% Asian American, that's unrepresentative of the society at large. Professor Wong, where do you see that? Do you think that there is, in the end, a tougher climb that Asian American students have to make because of that factor?
You know, having fought my own university, you know, UC Berkeley, for 5 years, from 1984 to 1989, I know that to be a fact, okay? And after 5 years of fighting my own institution...
Fighting to do what?
To policies that were discriminatory against Asian American applicants. At the end of that 5 years, I think the chancellor of the university, Chancellor Ira Heyman, finally came out publicly and admitted that the policies that instituted under his administration were wrong, and that he apologized for it. Mm. And so that finally got settled. So there's no question in my mind. Now, the problem here is that, see, there's a perception within the Asian American community that the elite universities are constantly changing the rules of admissions. Mm. So, you know, in the past, they say, oh, you know, you have to have the legacy. You have to have be a children of alumni who have advantage, or you have to have athletic skills, or you have to have leadership, you have to have extracurricular activities. I mean, there's all kinds of criteria that got periodically introduced. And within the Asian American community, I think there's this perception that the universities are constantly changing rule, almost targeting them. You know, and there is some truth to that. I mean, for instance, in California, since 1996, the passage of the Prop 209 that banned affirmative action from the public universities in California, university has changed its admissions policy several times, and each time it failed to achieve what it wanted to do, which is to increase diversity, which I'm all for it.
Professor Ling-Chu Wong, he was a longtime faculty member at UC Berkeley, joining us this hour along with Daniel Golden, an editor at Bloomberg News and author of The Price of Admission, and Angela Saum, who is now an academic consultant working out of Boston. In a moment, we'll also hear from someone who worked on the UC admission revisions. Mark Rashid will join us in just a few moments. But I want to come back, Dan Goldman, to the point that Angela Saum made, which was that it's not just a numbers game. Indeed, if you looked at it just by numbers, perhaps there should be a higher percentage of Asian American students at these elite universities. But she's saying that's not what it's all about, that there is a broader construction that you have to make. How do you respond to that?
Well, in a couple ways. I mean, I think the first thing I'd respond to is that she seems to be kind of making the implicit suggestion that while Asian students may be outstanding in academics and grades and test scores and science fairs and everything else that I mentioned, they may not be equally outstanding in talent or character or leadership. And I just don't see any grounds for that. It sounds to me a bit like ethnic stereotyping. I mean, my sense of years of covering education is that students who are outstanding academically tend also to be outstanding in other ways as well. And there was a recent column in the Boston Globe by a former Yale admissions officer who was talking about this issue and said that it became immediately clear to me that Asians face an uphill slog. And then she talked about their great scores and AP offerings. She said they also shine in extracurricular activities. Frequently, they also had hard knock stories. Families that had immigrated to America under difficult circumstances, parents working as kitchen assistants and store clerks, and households in which no English was spoken. So, I mean, I think that, you know, it's unfairly criticizing or this group of students to say that they aren't equally outstanding in other ways. Now, the other point I would make is that, you know, everybody criticizes test scores and grades, and they're kind of like democracy. You know, it's a lousy system until you look at the alternatives. And when you get away from those, you get more and more subjective. And that opens the way, as you mentioned, for universities to make decisions that are related to the wealth and influence of the applicant family. You know, schools like Harvard give preference to the children of alumni. They give preference to so-called development admits, children of wealthy people who are not alumni but in a position to give to the university. And so there's a danger in going back to kind of a subjective system. Not that test scores are totally objective, but at least it's a number sort of across the nation. If you go back to a completely subjective system, you go back to a world where wealth and influence have free reign.
But Angela Sahm, I assume part of your rejoinder to that would be that you want a student body that is diverse in many ways, not just in terms of race or ethnicity, but also in terms of talent, that you want people who can dance, you want people who can run fast, you want people who can perform in a variety of ways, both in the classroom, but also to make the university environment one that has all of this jostling of different talents and forces.
Exactly. I think I can speak myself. I am a second-generation Korean-American where my parents were immigrants. I had no advantage. I also went through the system and as an admissions officer worked with fellow Asian-American admissions officers. And I can only speak to what I saw and what I did as an admissions officer at these schools like Harvard and MIT, where you're right, Professor Wong, there's the perception, I know, these common held perceptions of these huge Ivy League white male-dominated institutions, you know, having a bias or putting up discriminatory walls to Asian students. But in fact, from my actual experience, it wasn't true. And that's what I was actually surprised by or impressed by. As much as I tried to be critical, without a doubt, it's not perfect. At the same time, going through the training and having spent years as an admissions officer, I did not once give advantage to non-Asians or give an inordinate advantage to one group or the other. My mandate, the mandate I received was to really seek out the most interesting, distinct, diverse group of individuals that could make up an ideal learning environment freshman class. You know, so again, I can only speak to what I saw and what I actually did and the way that I was trained to read applications.
I don't, not to be simplistic about it, but Professor Wong, does this mean in a sense that Asian American students, you were talking before about how there's this sense that the rules keep changing. We're doing, you know, we're studying hard, we're getting good grades, we're scoring high on the SATs, but now they want something else. Is that, though, in the end, the reality that Asian American students need to perfect other kinds of attributes if they're going to be competitive in the system that Angela Sahm describes?
Absolutely. And I think that as long as you give the Asian American applicants an opportunity to meet those new criteria, then I think it's fair game. But the problem oftentimes is that these rules get changed oftentimes without much public notice.
But well, for the past 20 years, there hasn't been much change, 20, 25 years. If you speak to the last 300 years, I mean, it's clear. The perception was even clear. But the past 20, 30 years, you know, it's very clear the admissions officers of these Ivy League universities have been striving to even the playing field, have been seeking out people who don't have advantage.
I think, Angela, I think there's we need to make a distinction because private institutions are different from public. California system is subject to the ban on affirmative action. And so since 1996, we have been modifying our admissions policy for six times.
Well, let's drill down then on the public side of this question, because one of the concerns that's been raised about this is not just in the private elite universities that we've been discussing, but also what's going to happen here at the University of California. Since Proposition 209, since the end of affirmative action, the percentage of Asian American students at the UCs has actually gone up substantially, now over 40% on most of the UC campuses. But there's also been now a new policy put in place that will go into effect in a couple of years that changes how the UC admits people. And it does a couple of things. It does do away with people having to take the SAT so-called subject tests. You'd still take the SATs, but you wouldn't have to take those specialty tests anymore. It also says you aren't guaranteed admission to the top 12.5% of high school graduate. It whittles that down to 9 and then allows for a broader review to take in sort of more personal characteristics. Mark Rashid is a civil engineering professor at the University of California, Davis, and he chaired the UC System Admissions Board from 2006 to 2008 in developing this new policy. Professor Rashid, thank thanks for joining us for this part of our conversation. And I want to ask you first about the intent of this change that was made, because there is concern, as you know, among the Asian American community that that will penalize them because those students have so often done very well on some of those things that will no longer be measured, like the SAT-2 or subject exams.
Well, first of all, good morning, David, and thanks for having me. Good morning to the other guests. First of all, I think it's important to be clear about what the new policy is. It has to do with eligibility in particular and not selection or admission at the campuses. So the new policy doesn't do anything to modify how students will actually be selected for admission at the campuses. Instead, all it does is open the door a little bit wider to, if you will, who's allowed to apply to the institution. And the primary way it does that, and you just mentioned, it eliminates what was found to be a superfluous testing requirement, I emphasize requirement, in the subject tests. So students can still submit those subject tests voluntarily if they wish, and they'll be considered, but the strict requirement that all freshmen applicants submit two subject tests would be eliminated.
And why superfluous? Why do you characterize the subject exams in that particular way?
Yeah, so that characterization, it derives from unequivocal statistical results that we see based on many tens of thousands of UC enrollees, freshman enrollees, where what we found is that once we know the other things that we're going to know anyway at the point of application, the scores on those subject tests tell us virtually nothing that's valuable in terms of predicting who will do well at UC when they actually come. And that's not just some kind of subjective value judgment. That's a rock-solid statistical result that we've seen over and over and over again. And it's not hard to understand why. It's that students, they can select which subject tests they take. They can take tests in which they excel, and in fact, at some level, that's sort of the point of the requirement, is to allow students to show to admissions officers that they, for example, that they know a particular subject perhaps better than their grade record may suggest, and they can still use the subject test in that fashion. It's just that UC will no longer be in the business of declaring students ineligible simply because they haven't taken the subject test.
Professor Rashid, we're coming up on our break in a moment. I want you to stay with us for as long as you can, but just give a brief response to the concern about how these changes, as you suggest, they widen the gate. They don't eliminate anyone, but that they will put Asian American students if not at a competitive disadvantage, at least they won't have quite the same advantage that perhaps they had in the past.
Yes, well, I think the concern in some quarters of the Asian community has derived from the fact that when we open the gate a little bit wider like that, then the percentage of the eligible pool that is Asian goes down a little bit, even though the number of students that are eligible to apply in every ethnic category goes up. It's just that Asian students right now, for whatever reason, make themselves eligible in hugely disproportionate numbers compared to any other group. Now, will that put them at a disadvantage when it comes, you know, time for admission, where they'll have to compete against slightly bigger applicant pools? I actually think that's very far-fetched.
All right, we'll hold it there and invite you to participate in our conversation now. If you're an Asian American student or parent, how do you see this subject? Do you feel like there is an extra bar that you have to climb over in order to be competitive for America's best academic institutions, be they private or public? We'll take your calls after our break. Here's the number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us your questions at forum@kqed.org, or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and then click on this segment, and we'll get your comments in that way. Back with more about this topic in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, college admissions, something that is the experience right now of many a family across the Bay Area as high school seniors learn whether or not they got into a particular college or not. And our focus this hour is whether or not Asian American students in particular have a sort of higher bar to climb across in this process because they disproportionately score well on some of these exams. Is there a problem with whether or not they're fair fairly represented at America's top academic institutions, both those that are private and those that are public as well. We're joined this hour by Angela Saum. She's a academic consultant in Boston, formerly admissions officer at both MIT and Harvard. Daniel Golden, editor-at-large at Bloomberg News and the author of The Price of Admission. Professor Lingxi Wang joins us, retired professor at UC Berkeley. And Mark Rashid at UC Davis. He chaired the UC System Admission Board Task Force on this topic from 2006 to 2008. You're welcome to join us, too. Our phone lines are full, but here's the number. We'll try to get in as many calls as we can at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Professor Rashid, just one more beat from you, then stay with us, please, to take and field questions. But I want to just see if I can get clarity on who will be affected by the changes that were put forward. One of the changes was that instead of having admission guaranteed if you were in the top 12.5% of your class, it would now be the top 9%. Is that one of the ways that, in the end, this will affect Asian American students because they're part of that 12.5% and now would not have – the gate wouldn't be as wide for them. Is that right?
Well, actually, Dave, the admission guarantee at the University of California is a very distinctive feature of our admissions process, is broadly misunderstood. What's actually being guaranteed is not admission to any particular campus,
right,
and specifically the highly sought-after campuses, but instead what's being guaranteed essentially is that you will, if you don't get admitted anywhere that you actually apply, then you will be admitted to UC Merced in the event that you're actually UC eligible. That's the admission guarantee. Now, very, very few students actually take UC's offer of a guaranteed slot at UC Merced. So I would say that the guarantee itself is almost superfluous, quite frankly. Students don't care about it. They don't take those offers. In many cases, they don't even know that they're subject to the guarantee. So the fact that the admission guarantee is moving from 12.5% of high school graduates in California down to, actually, it's more like about 10.5%, is essentially a non-issue.
Professor Wang, what are your concerns about this? I know this is something that's concerned you greatly in recent years as this change was contemplated. What's your primary issue?
My primary concern is that, you know, this new policy will have an adverse impact on Asian American applicants. And there have been three simulation studies that I know of. One was done in late 2008, and then another one in mid-2009, and then the latest one came out in January. Now, the intent of broadening the applicant pool, I think, is a good one, that, you know, to increase diversity. And it will. If you increase the number of applicants, obviously it will become much more diverse. But the outcome, however, is the what is concerned to many of us. And the first simulation suggests that there is no real change in diversity. The only really significant changes that would have taken place based on the first simulation studies is that Asian American admission will be reduced from 10 to 20%, and then white enrollment will be increased from 20 to 30%, and there's virtually no change on black and Latino. The second simulation shows that the blacks will be severely affected by the a huge drop depending on the campuses that they apply to, and the Latinos not so severe, and Asian American also will drop. The only group that really will not be affected severely will be the white that will actually benefit from
it. So your view in the end is that this will be counterproductive to achieving.
Absolutely. It certainly will not help achieve that diversity.
I want to come back to this, and Professor Rashid, I will give you a chance to respond, because those are important questions. But I do want to include our callers at this point, and then we'll recircle and get back to the UC question in particular. But let's invite our callers into our conversation right now. Doug in San Jose is first up. Doug, go ahead.
Hi. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. You're on.
Okay, great. Yeah, great topic, by the way. I really appreciate it. This one's sort of for Angela, I think. So I want to say this sort of mimics what we ran into with our daughter. She's half and half, 2,400 SATs, you know, all the extracurriculars, APs, et cetera. And she applied to all of Princeton, Harvard, Yale. She got into Princeton. She didn't get into Harvard or Yale. And the fascinating thing was that and other schools that were all just like sending her separate letters saying we really want her, And she'd get into like two schools and two schools that weren't, didn't even send her letters, just waitlisted her. It seems like, and this is what our counselor kind of said, is that it's just kind of, once you get to that level, there's so many people applying now that it's almost a crapshoot as to whether or not you caught someone's attention and just stood out for that. So we always kind of look at it as, hey, you know, you got into one of the three schools, you stood out there, you need to ignore the fact that you didn't catch the eye of someone else at the other two schools. It is what it is, almost. Whereas they were saying like 15, 20 years ago, you would have gotten into every school that you applied to.
Doug, so thanks. Let Angela respond. There is a part of this really is somehow catching the eye, because admissions officers are flooded with thousands and thousands of applications to read.
I mean, I admit that is true. Whether it's the essay or whether it's the interview, whether it is one particular involvement that you are passionate about, I think that's where strategy comes in your essay topic and how you approach the whole application. It is very true that you're trying, an applicant should try to catch the eye, be memorable as, you know, one of whatever 30, 40,000 who are applying, be a memorable person on paper through the recommendations, through the interview reports. So I don't know if crapshoot is the right word, but I advise every high school senior to really strive to emphasize and highlight the thing that would make them memorable.
And Daniel Golden, is that precisely what bothers you, though, is that that becomes that much more a subjective process, that it becomes dependent on an ability to tell a story or to somehow distinguish yourself in ways that aren't necessarily as objectively measured?
That's not what bothers me. I think something else about this bothers me. The thing that does bother me is that he mentioned his daughter was half Asian, had a 2400 SAT score and got into, you know, one school but not others. This issue came up in the case of the student who applied to Princeton with a perfect SAT score and didn't get in. And Princeton said, well, you know, we turned down a lot of students with perfect SAT scores. But what they never said was the ethnic racial breakdown of those with perfect test scores whom they didn't admit. I think the big concern, and probably why the government is still looking at this case, is that if you look at those who are turned down with perfect test scores, you're going to find that a disproportionate number of them are Asian American.
And that if you have a perfect SAT score and your parent is a big donor or you're a great athlete, you're not going to get turned down, right?
That's right. Or if you're a member of another ethnic group, you're less likely to be turned down. I mean, if that's not the case, I'd love to see the numbers of the breakdown of students with perfect test scores by ethnic group and how they fare. Now, the other point, don't misread me as thinking that I think that, you know, test scores and grades are the end all and be all. I mean, I favor, you know, a very close individual review if it's possible. I mean, if a student has a tremendous talent at art or music or dance or and any science, anything else, I certainly think that that's very important. I mean, in my book, I use the example of Cooper Union, which is, you know, an art and architecture engineering school. You know, it's a terrific school, and they look at portfolios, you know, as well as other. That's one of their major criteria. You know, my argument in my book is simply, don't use parental wealth as your as a major criteria. You know, anything is better than using money. And the reality is, when these schools say, "Oh, we consider talent, we consider character, we consider leadership, we consider essay," they often also consider wealth. And wealth in this country is very often correlated with race. So you end up with the children of donors, major donors coming in disproportionately, and alumni, you end up with a disproportionately white representation there, as well as rich and white.
Angela Sahm, sounded like you wanted to respond to that. Can you, on whether or not, when you're looking at those applications, when you were at either Harvard or MIT, are you saying that that was never a factor, whether or not someone was the son or daughter of an alumnus, or whether or not they were big donors?
Well, again, from my experience, 7+ years of working as an admissions officer, I never once admitted anyone who did not have what we were looking for, the character, the personality, plus the academic credentials necessary to survive at MIT or Harvard, who just had money or connections or famous parents. You know, again, I feel like this is a major perception out there. When it comes to building an ideal class, is it interesting to have Bette Midler's daughter as a roommate? She also happened to be, this is, you know, this is at Yale, but she also happened to have outstanding academic credentials, you know, but the fact that, what did she singularly get in because she was someone's daughter? No.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, so there are many wealthy people, many legacy children, many of them who apply and do not get in.
Of course, but they get in, you know, they get in at a higher percentage. And there's also a distinction that I think you're making but not quite articulating between being qualified and being the best. I mean, you know, even in my book where I show many examples of children of wealthy parents or of alumni who get in with, you know, SAT scores far lower than the average and grades far lower, they're still qualified in the sense that the definition that colleges apply to that word, which is they're able to graduate. But are they, you know, in a place that only admits, you know, 7, 8, 9% of its applicants, are they the absolute best that that college could admit? And that's what I question.
And let's hear from more of our questions from more of our listeners this morning. John in Martinez has a question. John, go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. You know, just it's a great subject from my perspective. I mean, I'm white, and just listening to the conversation, the idea, I'm having trouble understanding how widening the broad base of potential applicants, how that's going to adversely affect diversity. Maybe I'm coming at this from a very simple point of view, but to me, if you broaden the potential applicants, you're going to get a more representative class. And one of the gentlemen, he talked about certain simulations, and I don't know how you could ever simulate something like that, but to me it just makes sense that if you have a broader base of potential applicants that you're going to have a more accurate representation of the class that you want to have.
John, thanks. Referring to the changes in the UC system, and Mark Rashid, go ahead and respond to that, because that's obviously the intent. The desire is to, as you put it, widen or open the gate further, and that's what John is saying that he thinks would happen. But you did hear Professor Wong say that in these simulation studies, and I've read news accounts of those as well, that the results of those didn't accomplish what you want to accomplish.
Yes, first of all, thanks for the question. Good question. Let me just preface my remarks by saying that the current policy does function to essentially disenfranchise large numbers of highly qualified potential applicants that are just deemed to be ineligible, chiefly because they don't take the SAT subject test, even though by every other measure, that 20,000 students or so usually is what it turns out to be, they're, by any stretch of the imagination, better qualified than some fully eligible UC applicants. So this kind of inversion was what we were attempting to address with the policy changes, and the caller is absolutely right that if you widen the door a little bit or even a substantial amount, then you are better able to do what UC is supposed to do, which is to offer the broadest possible access to you know, California students. Now, as far as the simulations go. First of all, the thing that Professor Wong didn't get to mention was that the third simulation studies that were done, which was in January of this year, showed essentially within the noise of race-neutral results. Now, the reason why the admit pool can be affected at all by opening the door to applicants a little wider is that once you do that, then presumably you will have some students applying that didn't used to apply, and some of those newly applying students will be better than or deemed to be better than and more admissible than some current applicants, and they'll push out the bottom of the applicant pool some currently admitted student. I would argue that irrespective of race and ethnicity of those who come in and those who get pushed out, this is really what UC should be doing, shouldn't it? I mean, offering the right to be reviewed to the broadest possible swath of qualified California applicants, and then just simply doing our best possible job that we can do of assessing their qualifications and excellence and admitting the best.
Some of our emails coming in. Ella writes, it's well documented that elites such as Harvard discriminated against Jews for decades. Now Jews are represented in numbers above their proportion in the population. If stereotypes conscious and unconscious about American, Asian American applicants held by admissions officers were removed, their numbers would rise. And why shouldn't? Why should race dominate? Aliyah writes, I would like to hear people describe the campus culture that admissions strives to create. What are the values and goals? Is there a sense that an overwhelming Asian American student body would fundamentally change the campus culture? And if so, what's wrong with that? Angela, you want to take that on?
Sure. I mean, this strikes actually at a question that I often pose to parents that I work with, and questions regarding possible discriminatory policies that that Harvard has. But you know, I often ask, would you want to send your child to a school that is 60% Asian? You know, do you think that is an ideal learning environment? I think in general, people see the value of diversity, see that that is an ideal learning environment. And
well, this is a really interesting point, and it's something the last email that I read spoke to, too. And Dan Golden respond. I mean, the emailer made the point, yeah, if that's how it checks out and you wind up with a 60% Asian American student body, then that's what you ought to do. How do you respond to that?
That is a tough question. I mean, but for me, I don't see that as a problem. I mean, many campuses are 60% or more white, and you know, people don't seem to complain about that. I mean, the way I view admissions is that it should try and find the best students, either of achievement or of potential. You know, some students have go to the best high schools and they have great talent and they do tremendously well. Other students face a barrier. They have equal potential, but they face a barrier either because of poverty or because of illness, or they move a lot, or they attend a low-quality high school, or in some cases because of racial prejudice. So I think that colleges should make special pains to identify those students who may not have scored as well or done as well, but would have given the chance, and hopefully that would ensure some diversity. But you know, if it shakes out that Asians are 60% of Harvard or Yale, it wouldn't bother me in the least, and I speak as a Harvard alumnus as well as the author of The Price of Admission.
Professor Wong.
You know, having taught in Berkeley for 40 years, I personally prefer a diverse class. Mm. I think it's more intellectually exciting. People raise questions. However, I think the question that was posed earlier was very interesting. For over 300 years, the Ivy League had 100% white male, and the question of diversity had never surfaced. You know, I think, you know, what's wrong? I mean, if that should happen, I mean, I do not want to teach a class that is 90% Asian Americans, because it would not be.
Or 90% exciting. Anything.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
To so, Jules, I'm sorry, Angela, quick response.
No, and that's exactly what we are striving to build, something that an environment that's healthy, that's well-balanced, that will stimulate discussion and intellectual personal growth for all of our undergraduates. That's a very clear 100%. No parent wants to send their child to, you know, a predominantly Asian. These are Asian parents I'm asking, predominantly Asian school.
And I mean, can I just say one thing? It's that you speak as if Asian is one culture. I mean, it's Asia's made up. You know, Asian immigrants come from many different countries with many different cultures and languages and religions, and you know, representing an enormous percentage of the world's population. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure. You know, it sounds like you're saying that Asian students are somehow identical. I mean, I think you have a lot of diversity in a lot of ways with 60% Asian student body.
It's an important point, it's a useful one as a reminder that when we're talking about Asian American students, too often in these conversations we focus on Chinese American, Japanese American, Korean American students, and less perhaps on Pacific Islanders, on people from Southeast Asia. So it's a useful point, but I do want to hear more from some of our listeners on this question. J.R. joins us next in San Francisco. J.R., go ahead.
Hi, I'm a professor at San Francisco State, and I wanted to ask the exact question that was brought up. When I look at my students, I can say that Asians are overrepresented. But then when I disaggregate the data, I find that it's very different if I'm talking about Chinese students or Thai students or even Western Asians like Afghanis or Pakistanis or whatever. So what's your answer to the question of overrepresentation when we talk about the 30 or 40 ethnicities that we aggregate in the Asian category?
JR, thanks. Anyone want to tackle that?
Sure, I will. This is Mark Rashid. First of all, I would say at some level it's kind of a shame to put
racial politics, if you will, at the very forefront of discussions about admissions. It's true that, you know, in UC, and I suspect at CSU as well, that Asians of every subcategory hugely overrepresented compared to their percentage in the population. Now, is that a problem? I mean, I've never, in all my years of working with admissions at UC, I've never heard anybody say, well, gee, you know, that's a problem, we have to do something about it. It would be kind of bizarre to hear that, I would think. You know, what has to be first and foremost in the consideration of admissions is qualifications. Those considerations have to be taken in the context in which students did their learning, certainly, and that's what we strive to do at UC. We talked a bit about wealth and so on, and how that might influence admissions decisions previously. At UC, being a public institution, it kind of works the other way. I mean, we're more likely to give a little boost to students who excelled at their high schools, despite the fact that they come from, for example, very low-income families.
Right. Do we want college admissions to be – we often talk about needs-blind admissions. In other words, it shouldn't matter whether you have money to pay for admission or not. What about admissions being ethnicity-blind? Here's the question that Susie raises. If the Ivies really were focused on recommendations, interview reports, extracurriculars, scores, why not make the process ethnicity-blind? Gender, name, ethnicity should not be asked in the application. The fact that it is a part of the admissions process clearly indicates that ethnicity matters.
It does.
And on to Larry in Berkeley. Larry, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I had a daughter who was in a private high school in San Francisco, which was about one-third Asian, and was competing for college last year. And, you know, her observation would be that many first-generation parents of Asian students have, you know, very high expectations that their children spend their time studying, doing well on the tests. And I'm reminded, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? You know, you practice. So if you're getting perfect SAT scores, you know, kids have limited time to go to school, do their homework, and if they spend a lot of time studying, many, many kids can get really good scores. But, you know, if you're on the one hand, you're arguing for a meritocracy, we have great scores. On the other hand, you're saying we want a diversity. And if you have a huge contingent of people with perfect scores, you know, what else do you look at?
Larry, thanks. Professor Wong, do you want to comment on that and on whether or not the cultural expectations that Larry is referring to do indeed play a real role in all of this, and whether or not you think that needs to change, whether or not Asian American parents need to look at this in a different way?
You know, absolutely. I think that there's no question in my mind that Asian American parents put tremendous amount of their personal resources, their time, and a lot of pressure on their kids. And, you know, it's very distressful to find kids having problem adjusting to a normal student life. And so, you know, absolutely. But I think the key of how in this discussion that we have had is really, how do you construct a freshman class? Mm-hmm. See, what are the criteria? And this is where the problem is, that these criteria to a lot of Asian Americans tend to be the type, end up with the kind of characteristics that will put Asian Americans at a disadvantage. But having said that, however, I also want to say that, you know, I don't think, you know, so far we have not talked about this. And that is, you know, in California, as a public university, I think the University of California need to have a lot more diverse student population. And Black and Latinos have been very, very much underrepresented. The Proposition 209, that banned affirmative action from UC, have created a situation where, you know, African Americans and Latinos were denied opportunity. And that is a serious problem.
Indeed, and one we'll have to revisit at a later time as well. We're short on time, so let me get in one more caller observation, and then we'll go around once and get everyone to chip in one more time if we can. Jules, quick observation, please.
Hi. I just want to say that this it astounds me, because it is an absolute replication of what happened to Jews in the 1930s and 40s, and you would have thought we'd be beyond that.
Yeah.
I've got a piece in the San Francisco Chronicle coming out this Sunday on exactly this subject. I'm delighted you're tackling it. It's infuriating, too.
Jules, thanks. Thanks for the observation. Quick last thoughts. Let's go around once. Angela Saw, what should we be thinking about this perplexing problem?
Well, I think I would like to, first of all, challenge the common perception, as the caller just mentioned, that we are back to the 1930s or the 1960s. As an Asian American officer who's read applications, made decisions, I saw for a fact that it wasn't quite that way. I went in with a critical eye and came out rather impressed that the system tries to provide opportunities to those who didn't have the advantages. I actually was impressed by the freedom I had to lobby for and admit those who were from single-parent families, whose parents did not go to college, who did not have the internships at Oxford. We actually were sent out by the admissions offices to seek out students from disadvantaged backgrounds, underrepresented minorities. It was an active measure that was taken from within the system.
I'm going to hold you there. Sorry to interject, but I want to hear one last time from Dan Golden, if I can. Ms. Golden, if you could change one thing, what would it be?
Well, I would, eliminate the role of wealth and influence and alumni status from the admissions process. But in terms of Asian Americans, I'd just like to say that I'm also struck, as the last caller is, by the parallel between how Jews were treated, before the Second World War and how Asians have been treated in recent years. And in Harvard, where Angela's from, the Justice Department did find in the 80s that it held Asians to a higher standard and said that was okay because not as many of them were legacies or athletes, and Harvard was entitled to discriminate in favor of legacies and athletes. But it quoted a great many statements from admissions officers in written evaluations that indicated a prejudice against Asian Americans. So I think there is a parallel in how they're treated. And, my deepest worry is that in future we'll look back and say, how could we have made this same mistake all over again?
And we'll have to leave it there. Professor Rashid, Professor Wong, sorry to not get in last comments from both of you, but we are out of time. Fascinating topic. We'll come back to it, I'm sure, and also tackle the subject again of the legacy of Proposition 209 and what can be done to make the UC system more diverse in the future. Thanks all very much for participating. Forum is produced by Tina Larberg, Kevin Guillory, and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is the engineer, and Raul Ramirez, the executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.